Me, oh boy.
The time for the start has arrived, so we will start the meeting, and we're just checking to see about quorum. I think we're just a little bit short of quorum yet, so we will officially call the meeting to order at that time and pass the minutes. But first on the docket, we have Joe. Which one are we going with? House file 3497, Representative Mariani. And if he is here, there he is.
This is going to
House file 3497. I move the House file 3497 to be moved to government operations. And with that, Representative Mariani, welcome to the committee. And if you could please state your name and your testifier can do that at this time.
Thank you, introduce your bill for us. Members, Representative Carlos Mariani from St. Paul, District 65B, and at least 6 years, maybe 8 years, I served on this committee a generation ago. It was a good experience, so I trust you're continuing to do good work for Minnesota. This is really, this bill is a pedicab bill. And in its essence, it basically creates the authority to be able to have electric assist on a pedicab. Now, some of you are asking, so what's a pedicab? They're not super well known in Minnesota. But since you're all residing in St. Paul for a good chunk of the year, you may have seen some of our pedicabs laboring up and down our streets here. It's a terrific way to move people around, particularly when it's warm, and particularly when there are big events that are happening across the city. In Minneapolis, there are about 40 or 50 men and women who drive pedicabs. In St. Paul, we have about 15 drivers. They are licensed because, in essence, they're capped, so we have to be able to have a licensed a presence for them. You'll often see them in St. Paul on Summit Avenue, West 7th, Grand Avenue, at the Saints game, for sure. The reason I brought this bill forward is because St. Paul is a little bit different from Minneapolis, some of you may have noticed. And one of the ways that we're different is that we're a pretty hilly town. I'm a cyclist myself, and I always tell people to be a cyclist in St. Paul means you have to be ready to climb hills. I've never attempted to transport someone in a pedicab up one of our hills, and I hope I never have to do that. It's tough. It's hard work. So this bill basically will then allow for the use of what's called an electric assist, which my understanding is basically something that generates about 1,000 watts in terms of energy for the vehicle in order to help get over that hump on a hill in St. Paul. St. Paul regulators have told us they have no statutory ability to authorize the use of electric assist, so obviously we need the state to create that. And the language in the bill is permissive, so we're not mandating that this happens. I suspect in Minneapolis they won't use it. They don't have bills there. But in St. Paul, we certainly do. As far as I know, the MnDOT has no issue with this bill. I believe they're neutral on it. Our own cities have also adopted a neutral stance on this bill. It's not part of their package, in part because this issue really surfaced pretty late, and so I thought it'd be important nonetheless to bring it before us so that particularly those small businesses and operators in St. Paul can have a little bit of help this year as they're peddling people up the Grand Hill, Summit Hill, and the hybrids over to the west side. So, members, that's really basically pretty much it, and ask for your support.
Thank you. And we do now have a quorum, so I will officially call the meeting of the committee together. And Representative Johnson, have you read the minutes, and would you like to approve the minutes of March 23rd?
Yes, I would like to move the minutes.
Minutes have been moved. All in favor, say aye.
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 Motion carries. And I think you do have a testifier, Representative. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, we do.
If you could please state your name for the record and continue on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Julian Lascalzo, and I wear numerous hats. The hats that I'm wearing today is one as part owner of Twin Town Pedicab, the general manager of the St. Paul operation, and a licensed pedicab driver. My experience in this kind of comes from a number of different areas. And the easiest statement is this, is that Twin Town Pedicab operates in both cities. And it became very clear to us in the last year or two that St. Paul is a city of hills. And a pedicab, just to help you with that, weighs 150 pounds, empty, has 21 gears. But if you put a couple folks in the back of it, I don't care particularly. Even the young folks. This is not a bill just for me, to be honest with you. It's even our younger drivers, when I told them that we needed to get electric assist, are right in there with us. So, again, it's a very simple, permissive bill. We approached the city licensing staff a few months ago regarding, and that's when they informed us that they did not feel that they had the statutory authority in order to operate, in order to issue the ability to use electric assist. And I worked with House Counsel Mr. Burrison on this bill and Mr. Marble. Just to prove our point, this is a sign. Pedicab drivers operate basically on tips. So one of the signs that we use on the back of our cabs, just to remind people in case they don't notice that we're huffing and puffing, just remind them the city of St. Paul is the city of hills and bluffs. So we would, not only myself, but all the pedicab drivers in the city of St. Paul would certainly appreciate your support.
Thank you so much. And I would certainly comment, you know, from the state office building here to the Capitol, we probably could use one here too. But
We did think of a ply at one point to maybe bring one or two over to get folks around a little bit. But there's still, you know, what you don't realize is that even that little grade from the front of the SOB up to University Avenue, you really learn, as Representative Mariani said, when you're a biker, you really figure out where the hills are. When you're a pedicab driver, you know where everyone is.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify for or against this particular bill? If not, Representative Mariani, would you like to have a final word?
I appreciate your support. It really is a small business assistance effort here. We're talking about small businesses. And, as Mr. Scalzo shared, even small grades in St. Paul are quite a chore when you're hauling, that kind of weight around. So appreciate your support.
Thank you. With that, I will renew my motion to refer this to state government operations. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Next, we'll do 2072, Representative Albright, Watercraft and Motor Vehicle. Representative Albright, you can introduce yourself and introduce the bill for us, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm here to give you a presentation on House File 2072, which basically, in a nutshell, provides for an opportunity for those that are of modest means to transfer some personal assets that would not be otherwise considered real property to a beneficiary. Maybe a little background for the benefit of this committee in terms of from an estate or a taxation perspective, that literally our lives are all about accumulating stuff. And that stuff really falls into two generic categories, real property as well as personal property. Now, real property, such as land, buildings, anything affixed to the earth, if you will, can be transferred through any number of financial legal means. But when it comes to personal property, which is anything movable, There are, it becomes problematic, such things as money, securities, insurance, trust certificates, those type of things. And as I would dare say in the bill that you have in front of you, 2072, that also includes motor vehicles as well as watercraft. Now, for purposes of consideration before this committee, we are going to hopefully just talk about motor vehicles. We have a stop in Chair McNamara's committee where we'll be talking about watercraft as well. But in light of that, most people of some means typically go to an attorney and prepare a trust document or a will that affects the transfer of these assets to next of kin, surviving spouse, beneficiaries of some note. But in most cases, with a small or even a very, very modest estate, it becomes very difficult for the executor to close that up, given the fact that in some cases you've got a small fishing boat, or in some cases a pickup or of some note that really has some intrinsic value, but really because of its personal property nature, needs to get transferred. Now, in most cases, that with an affidavit of domicile and some other effects, you can do that, but in some cases it might take up to 9 months to close out that estate. The bill in front of you actually affords the opportunity through a transfer on death beneficiary designation on a title transfer to allow for a grantor or the owner of that property to transfer it directly to the beneficiary upon his or her death. You'll see the summary that you have in front of you. There is, some stipulations that are of note that I'd just like to go over with you. Principally, this allows for the beneficiary to be changed anytime by the owner. It provides the transfer is subject to the rights of third parties, and the rights of third party continue that after the transfer. It requires any secured interest or lien on the vehicle to remain attached. It does not require the beneficiary to pay any amount of money for the beneficiary designation or the transfer other than the cost of a new title when the previous owner has passed. Does not require the beneficiary to agree to the beneficiary designation. And it also provides that the vehicle would become part of the decedent's estate if the beneficiary died before the decedent. That, in a nutshell, Mr. Chair and members, is the gist of the bill, and I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative. And before that occurs, let me just move the bill to be referred to Environment and Natural Resources. If I might clarify, so this would be in situations where there is not joint ownership on the vehicle or whatever it's currently, and would be only for those that do not have a designation at that time. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Okay.
Any other questions or concerns? Representative Norton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I understood this last piece and that you said, and I'm looking over some notes, and it says the same thing. So the person that you designate as a beneficiary doesn't have to agree to it, but the lien goes with the vehicle, and so you don't want it, somebody's given it to you, and there's still payments on it. Are you stuck with it then?
You could refuse it. Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, you could refuse it.
Representative Norton?
Okay. No, as long as there's a way for the person to refuse it and not be stuck with someone else's debt that they weren't expecting, that would be good with me.
Representative Erhard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I assume it's still part of the deceased estate, however.
Representative Nair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erhard, that is a correct statement. It is continues to be part of the decedent's estate.
Thank you.
Representative Erhard.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Are there any other people from the audience? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Albright, I've been in situations where title is transferred very easily after someone died. Are there hang-ups that other people have that I didn't have? Or
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Representative Johnson, yes. In some cases, based upon the DMV that you're dealing with, and/or the type of estate asset or the type of individual that you're dealing with, there may be a difficulty in transferring it based upon the age of the motor vehicle, based upon the titling maybe not being clear. This is an opportunity for them to clarify that before the grantor passes, so that it's clear to the beneficiary.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you. And then my follow-up would be, with this, I could see where it could be more difficult with a high-priced vehicle and one that may have a lien on it, but if it's a low-priced vehicle that does not have a lien that would normally transfer easily, would the citizen have to go through all the steps that are included in this bill to allow that vehicle to transfer?
Representative Albright?
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, Johnson, in most cases at the DMV, when you're going for retitling, you're designating who the owner under a transfer of death would become. And so that mechanism would replace such things as an affidavit of domicile, an original death certificate, those types of forms that may take time. And so in the course of events in the life of an estate winding down, most of the cases, the beneficiaries would just like to wrap it up and move either the, you know, dad or grandpa's pickup onto the beneficiary or the fishing boat, so it doesn't lay dormant or stay outside, you know, back of the garage and in a sense decay or, you know, become forgotten or lost in the process of winding down the estate.
Representative Johnson?
Thank you again. I guess I'm still not. I want to be clear that where it is easy, for instance, in my dad's pickup that just easily transferred, I wouldn't have to fill up a bunch of forms to get that done. And
Representative Albright?
Chair, Representative Johnson, if you already accomplished what you hope to effect by the designation on the title for that vehicle, you would not necessarily need to do this. But for others that do find it convenient, this is a means by which they can effect the same change.
Thank you.
Any other questions or discussions? If not, I will renew my motion to refer this on to Environmental and Natural Resources. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative I'm sorry, I keep doing that. Representative Albright. I think we're going to go with 3067. Chair Kelly. Chair Kelly, would you like to move your...
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move House File 3067. I do have an amendment. I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Is there any discussion? All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carried. To your amended motion. And you're moving this to Ways and Means?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chair, members, this is the department's bill, and with me is Mr. Dean, who is going to walk through. The amendment that we did approve had to do with the utility costs of moving utility lines, so that section is taken out of the bill. Just so members do know, we did just get a fiscal note back on that, and there is actually to the department's bill a savings, a small savings, but there is a savings is the result of this. So I commend the department for doing it.
Thank you, Ms. Radin, and if you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Radin with MnDOT Government Affairs, and I'll just briefly walk through the bill.
Please go ahead.
Section 1 revises language that was enacted in 2015 regarding the distribution of county state aid highway funds. Last year, the law was amended to specify that the apportionment sum is 68% of the county state aid highway distribution amount, and the excess sum is 32%. The language we're amending this year provides further details on the excess sum calculation, and so we're just updating that language to reflect what the legislature enacted last year. Section 3 of the bill changes an annual report on the bridge program to a biennial report. These are large projects, multi-year projects, and so we felt that it was appropriate to change to an every other year report. And as Representative Kelly indicated, there is a small cost savings from that change. Section 4 of the bill amends Minnesota statutes to include language regarding holders of a commercial driver's license permit. Federal regulations require that states show on the commercial driver's record all convictions for any violation except parking tickets in any type of motor vehicle. And noncompliance with federal regulations would jeopardize federal highway funding. So we're just clarifying that a person with a learner's permit for a commercial driver's license is also subject to this law. Section 5 of the bill implements a recommendation from the legislative auditor to eliminate equal computation of equal design lives. So MnDOT will continue to compare pavement alternatives over a life cycle, but we would no longer do this specific computation. And again, that's a recommendation from the legislative auditor. And eliminating that requirement does have a small cost savings as well. Sections 6 to 10 of the bill change the effective date for a provision that links overweight truck permits with vehicle registration. When this legislation was enacted in 2014, you can see that it had a 2016 effective date, and so we're asking that be delayed an additional 2 years. And then Section 11 of the bill turns jurisdiction of Highway 225 over to Becker County. You should have a map of that proposed turnback that was just distributed. It's about 9 miles long, and as you may know, all trunk highways are listed in state statute, so before we can turn jurisdiction over to a local unit of government, we have to ask the legislature to repeal the route in state statute. The county is supportive of this change.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question for the author or Mr. Rudine, and that is regarding the pavement life cycle cost analysis on 4.31. Can you? I might have missed if you explain this in more depth, but you're taking out equal design lives. I mean, as I understand, you do bituminous and also concrete, or is that what you call it, concrete? And, I mean, that can last twice as long. What I'm reading here is that you're not going to take that factor in, that it could last twice as long. Is that accurate? Can you please explain that a little bit more?
Mr. Rudine?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bernardi, no, we will still compare bituminous to concrete over a set number of years. But this requirement to do an equal design life, it's not possible to design, for example, a 50-year bituminous pavement. And so what we would do is we would say we're going to have a 15-year bituminous and then another 15 years so that you would get to 50 years. But it's not physically possible to design a pavement in some cases to meet that specified window. So that was the recommendation from the legislative auditor, was that we eliminate that specific requirement, but we still would compare the two pavements over some set number of years.
Representative Bernardi?
I think that takes care of it. Thanks.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rudine, you mentioned savings a couple times in here. Have you any idea what your estimate of the savings on these various components would be?
Mr. Rudine.
Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, there is a fiscal note. I'm not sure if you have a copy of that, but the estimated savings in fiscal 2017 would be $34,000, and then in fiscal 18, $49,000, and fiscal 19 would be $75,000.
Representative Earhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Has that been counted toward your goal of 15% efficiencies?
Mr. Rudine?
Mr. Chair, I imagine we could count it towards, yes, it's becoming more
Mr.
efficient.
Mr. Chairman, I want to make sure you get those marked and stack them up so we can see if they actually equal 15%.
Any other questions from the committees? Is there anybody from the audience who would like to testify for or against this particular bill? Chair Kelly, do you have any other final comments?
No, Mr. Chair and members, I would renew my motion that House File 3067 be referred to Ways and Means.
The motion has been renewed to move this on to Ways and Means. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your presentation. We'll go next to House File 3155. Representative Packer. Okay, House File 3155, I believe, is going to go to government operations after this, so I will move 3155 on to government operations. Representative Backer, please present your bill.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and members of the committee. House File 3155, what it does is it really gives more flexibility to smaller communities in regards with transportation. Some of you may or may not know that I am representative to a district that has 42 communities. So transportation is really big. It's the second largest. So what this bill does is it really allows the corner of commerce funding to go outside of what it has been and give flexibility to communities that make up a large percentage of our state. So with that, I'm going to turn that over to my testifier, Mark Giesker. Geeske, thank you. I told him I wasn't going to get it right. So, and he's with MnDOT, and I'll turn it over to Mark. Thank you.
Welcome, Mr. Geeske, and if you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Geeske. I'm the director of the Office of Transportation System Management at MnDOT, which is where our planning and programming function resides in management of the Quarters of Commerce program. House File 3155 makes a change to the project eligibility requirements of the program. Currently, the way the law is written, projects to be eligible must either be inside the metro district, which is the 8-county metro area, or if it's outside the metro district, it needs to be on one of the interregional corridors, which there's a map coming around where you'll be able to take a look at what those include. This change would allow also quarters of commerce funds to be spent on any urban city, any city that's outside the metro district, whether it's on an interregional corridor or not. So I'll give you a little background on that, so it kind of give you kind of the picture of why we're asking for that. The quarters of commerce program is in the statute, and there are two program categories that are defined in the statute. One of them is for capacity projects, and one of them is for preservation projects. So when MnDOT kind of set up the program, when the law was first passed, we divided those two categories into a couple of other smaller categories so that the like projects would compete against each other. So, for example, in the capacity, we have metro capacity projects and greater Minnesota capacity projects. The freight preservation category was divided into three categories at the time. We called one bottleneck removal. We had one for preservation, such as removing a restricted or deficient bridge. And we had a third category that we called Main Streets. Main Streets is not specifically identified in the statute, but it was created because it had a really good fit to a lot of the criteria that are in Quarters of Commerce, and it had strong support both from MnDOT and the local agencies. So now I think the handouts that are finally coming around to you, you can take a look at a picture of what we mean by a Main Street project. There's a couple of pictures. On one side, you'll see pictures from Battle Lake. You'll see a before and after picture, so that's the one we're looking at. Trunk highways that go through cities, are particularly ones that serve as main streets or pass through a business district, are troublesome for MnDOT to address. They're more expensive. There's extra width, there's drainage infrastructure, there's sidewalks, a lot of things that aren't on a normal rural highway. For cities, they're also an expensive replacement cost. They often need to address their underground utility issues, and that usually requires removing all of the pavement and all of the infrastructure above them. So they're an important but expensive project for both MnDOT and the cities. So in the examples we have here in the pictures, the one you see from Battle Lake, this was completed without Corridors of Commerce funds. These were done before the program existed, but it's an example of what we would do if there were a Main Street program in Corridors of Commerce. You can see the before and after picture. You can see how the project improved the Main Street with better traffic flow. There's wider sidewalks, sidewalk amenities like outdoor seating, and a more attractive, updated appearance that can remove a barrier to commerce and improve that city's economic competitiveness. And I'll just point out while we're on the picture that not everything in that picture is something that MnDOT pays for. This is a partnership with the city, so we pay for the usual transportation kind of components of that, the pavement, the curb and gutter. The city pays for the other things that are added on, the extra width for the sidewalk, the trees, the landscaping, and those kinds of things. On the other side is another picture. That's not a before and after, but that's a picture of the St. Peter project on Trent Highway 169. Again, you can see what it looks like with a completed Main Street project. So we think that the Main Street project category is a good fit for the Corridors of Commerce program under this freight improvement preservation category. It's a good fit for two to three of the program classifications that are in the statute. It's a good fit for removing or reducing barriers to commerce. It's a good fit for easing or preserving freight movement. It may, depending upon what's around that that highway, support emerging industries. So we think it's a good fit in the freight improvement preservation category. We also think it matches well with the prioritization criteria that are in the statute. There are seven. The first one's return on investment. Now, these projects are usually expensive, so oftentimes the return on investment is not necessarily that high. But of the seven, it's a good fit with probably five of them. They have an impact on commerce and economic competitiveness. It helps make it more efficient freight movement in the city. And you can see from the pictures how it could improve traffic safety with better traffic flow and crosswalks and those kinds of things. It addresses multiple transportation system policy objectives. There's vehicle transportation, there's bicycles, there's pedestrians, there's partnerships with the city. All of those kinds of things are system objectives. And there's strong support by nature of the projects from members of the surrounding community. The other handout that you had that came around was the map of the interregional corridor system. So that, just to review, that shows you where, when you're outside of the metro district, those darker roads, those are considered part of the interregional corridor system. That's what Corridors of Commerce money can be used for. So any city that's not on one of those highways is currently not eligible, and that is the objective of House File 3155, to make those other cities, which are a little concentrations of commercial activity, eligible for Corridors of Commerce funding.
Thank you. Are there any questions for members? Representative Bernard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kieske?
Yep.
Very good. Could you explain to me a little bit more in depth of how this impacts all the trunk highways that are main streets in the metropolitan area, like Snelling, West 7th, University Avenue, Central Avenue,
Mr. Kieske.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Currently, all of those highways would be eligible just by the fact that they're in the metro district, whether it was a Main Street improvement or any of the other kinds of improvements that can be done in Corridors of Commerce. But certainly there are trunk highways in the metro district that do function as a main street. They're not all freeways.
Senator Bernardi.
Thank you. And can you share with me how many projects have been done in greater Minnesota on trunk highways that serve as main streets, and how many have been done in the metro area under the Corridors of Commerce program?
Mr. Geese.
Mr. Chair, none have been done in greater Minnesota with Corridors of Commerce. The two, three appropriations that we've had They were done fairly quickly. The thing about these Main Street projects is they often take a lot of lead time to develop because cities need to get their funding in line, and it's not something you can do quickly. Even though we were open to doing some, there were no candidates to do, so none have been done.
Okay. Senator Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then my follow-up question is the legislative auditor, I believe in this program, commented about having things to be shovel-ready, or that was one of the criteria to get them higher up on the list. And you just talked about that they weren't ready. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that and how you're going to move forward as an agency in addressing the issue that Auditor Nobles raised?
Mr. Gieske.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of the things that we're doing in response to the audit are looking at some of these programs and looking at the kinds of projects that might be eligible for those programs so that when and if funding becomes available, we would have had some time to contemplate what kind of projects would be ready or more ready. So even though we may not be certain that money is coming, we know that some can come and probably will come at some time. So we'll be working with our partners, especially on these kind of Main Street projects, to make sure that there is something in the pipeline that we can bring forward.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the Main Street projects. Are there any Main Street projects that are currently on the plan? Is the 10 or 20 year plan that are identified to be done in rural Minnesota?
Mr. Gieske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't know. There are none under the Corridors of Commerce program. I'm sure there are some, but I don't know right now how many there are. I could find out, though, and get that back to you.
Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair, thank you. As I'm looking at this, I guess I just have a little bit of concern, and part of that maybe if we had endless pots of money and the Corridors of Commerce was a well-funded regular program, I guess I wouldn't have the concerns, but we don't have enough money to even fund the corridor from, you know, the outskirts to the outskirts, the main trunk. And so when I think about spending money in the inner, you know, on a main street or in the city, which will cost more than just laying, I would guess, from the curbing and the, you know, these pictures are quite nice, and including, I kind of laughed in Battle Lake, apparently they need a person even before and after to control their traffic, which was a little odd, but so I guess I'm a little concerned with if we have more expensive projects that we're going to spend on Main Street rather than spending the limited funds we have on those highway corridors. I guess I'm just worried about what it would do to the program potentially, and so I guess I just have a little trepidation thinking about that, and I don't know if you have an explanation, and maybe I'm worried needlessly.
Mr. Geese.
I guess my response to that would be that, I mean, yes, that's true. I mean, there's a limited amount of money, and these are per mile more expensive. They're very difficult for that reason to get to with our current funding and our normal program. Compared to a large expansion project, in total dollars, they're small by comparison, but per mile they're more expensive, which is what makes them difficult to program. That's a true observation.
Representative Norton.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess for that reason, it seems to me that something like this probably needs to happen at some point. To me, and this is just me speaking, I would worry that we are undermining what we really wanted to do with Corridors of Commerce at this time. And it seems to me perhaps if we can make some headway on these corridors that we've already identified, some of which have been started at certain points but not even connected all the way through, that those should take priority, and that perhaps the time for this might be a few years down the road rather than putting it in there and perhaps causing problems when selections come. So I guess I just will share that thought.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to follow up by how much money is currently allocated to the Corridors of Commerce program? Is there any money in the kitty?
Mr. Gieske.
Mr. Chair, the money that's been available is the $300 million from the first appropriation in 2013. $6.5 million the next year and $25 million the year after. It's all been earmarked or assigned to projects. There is some savings that has accumulated from the first $300 million that is at the moment not obligated to any particular project, but there's no other money that is available for new projects.
Representative Johnson?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have to speak against the bill. This is a creates a competition for obviously not only limited funds, zero funds currently, and we hope to change that, obviously, and I think a lot of us are working on that. But the Corridors of Commerce program was really implemented to address a need in the state that was not being addressed through the regular funding process. That's why my question about how many main streets have been funded or are planned to be funded, and that happens. What we don't see happening is where we have the breakup from four-lane to two-lane to four-lane to two-lane on these interregional corridors where there's a heck of a lot of freight. I find it still interesting that in Nicollet, Minnesota, one out of four vehicles going through Nicollet, Minnesota on Highway 14 is a truck. One out of four, and there's a lot of traffic. There's just, and so that's what the purpose of the Corridors of Commerce program is, and if we do this, it will dilute that. I appreciate the need for this. You give me, St. Peter's a good example of that. Was actually federal money that helped pay for that. It was the stimulus money that helped St. Peter rebuild its main street, and that's another street that's got truck after truck, and that has to be done as well. But if we dilute the Corridors of Commerce, the program without any funding as of today, if we dilute the criteria for that, for this, I can't see how we'll ever get Highway 23, Highway 14, these highways completed, the expansion needed for greater Minnesota to grow. So, Representative Backer, I appreciate what you're trying to do. This is a need. But if anything, it just highlights, again, members of this committee and members of the public, that we have to deal with transportation. These needs exist. They exist in Main Street, rural Minnesota. They exist in the corridors, and we've got to address that. And this is our challenge this session. I'll use this chance to talk about it. I've said it time and again. We've got to find a way to come together to get a long-term solution with long-term dedicated funding to the Corridors of Commerce and other roads and bridges in Minnesota. That's our challenge this time. And until we've done that, we can't be making these maneuvers. And so I have to vote against this bill moving forward. Sorry.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to ask Mr. Gieske a question regarding MnDOT's plan. Is it the 10-year plan? What the plan they're doing to fully fund transportation? In that plan, is there money planned for it to be able to address these needs on Main Streets and the entire Corridor of Commerce program? Or, what I don't want to happen, the reason I'm asking this question, I don't want myself or the public to believe that MnDOT's coming up with a number that they'll be able to fully fund their program, and then after it gets passed, we find out, oh, well, we didn't plan for the main streets, or we didn't plan for more regional corridors, and, you know, we didn't plan for a multimodal transportation system. So I really would like to know, is these needs in that plan that MnDOT is projecting?
Mr. Gieske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that they would be in there in the sense that all the pavements were considered for needs, whatever those needs were. And I guess I would have to check and see how many of these kinds of projects were included, or if there were any, for the extra costs that would come with a Main Street project.
Representative Bernardi?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would like to get that information because I'm finding it on other things where it wasn't included in the big projection. And if I'm to vote on something and that's something I care a lot about, I would find out I just voted for not for those types of projects when the spirit of intent was like they were going to fully fund their program.
Mr. McKeeske or Representative Becker?
What was that again?
If you had any comments? As a follow-up question, one of the things that I think is a concern for local municipalities and so forth is that when you go through and do these projects, so much of it is underground infrastructure with sewers and so forth, and I think that's where really the timing is needed for additional funding and permits and all of that stuff. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. I mean, being mayor of our community, that's something that we have to do a lot of efforts and comments talking about truck traffic and so forth, and I appreciate that. Out in greater Minnesota, we have a lot of truck traffic because ag is our industry. And and ag currently makes up roughly 20% of our state's economy. So we're just looking for, in greater Minnesota communities, another source to help continue to provide those goods going to market and so forth.
Thank you. And Mr. Giese, another question that I've had for a little while in regards to some of these programs that come up fairly quickly, such as Court of Commerce had, is there any current loan program or anything for cities or municipalities to use that allow them to get the funding quicker so they could move ahead with the department at this point?
Mr. Chair, yes, there is a transportation revolving loan fund program that is available. The amount of funding varies depending on the activity, but that is an available program.
All right, thank you. Are there any other questions from the committee? Anybody else from the audience that'd like to testify? So I think we're going to, because there are questions in regards to this bill, I think we are going to move to lay this over for possible inclusion and possible direction, and so we will keep it in the committee for now. But thank you, Representative Backer, and thank you, Mr. Giese, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next up on, we'll have House File 3517, and Representative Neuberger, if you would like to come forth. And I will move House File 3517 to be moved to Government Operations, and Representative Neuberger, welcome, and please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I made a grave mistake last time I testified in front of this committee. I didn't bring treats. Today I brought half a roll of Lifesavers. So if you are so inclined, there are your treats. With that, members, we have a bill before us today that addresses the commercial and private use of drones. And what we're trying to do here is to bring some type of stability to their use. I will say there is a caveat to the bill. We've been working a lot with the stakeholders in this industry, with the insurance industry, also with the Department of Transportation and Aeronautics. We've been working trying to get everyone to come to a mutually disagreeable solution, and I think we have. At this time, that language has, there is a delete all amendment, and it has been passed, and it's moving quite well through the Senate. They were not able to get the delete all amendment to this from the Senate to this committee in time to meet the deadlines. So the bill that we have before us will be amended at its next stop to match up with what we're doing in the Senate. Members, to the bill, basically what this does is it defines our unmanned aircraft systems. On lines 110, as you want to walk through this real quick, it defines what we have working here. And it also, as we move forward, some of this is pre-existing language. As you see, there's misdemeanor penalties for not using these in accordance to the law. The new language that will be amended on the next stop, but it is the foundation of what we're trying to do here. You will find on line 3.22, that's where things start to pick up here. There's a consent component. If someone is using a drone over private property or land, water, if there's private property, there needs to be a consent. There's also some restrictions as to not just everyone can use these. There's a public safety component talks about, if you go down to line 3.34, picks up with the interference of other operations of manned aircraft. We also respect some private property rights as well. You can't just launch or recover a drone from state or private property without consent. As you move forward through the bill, if you get down to subdivision 9 on 4.15, it talks about if you are a repeat offender, it'll bring it from a misdemeanor up to a gross misdemeanor. Especially here, if you look at subdivision 10, we were focused here on the careless and reckless operation use of these drones. As we move forward through the bill, it addresses commercial uses. It talks about what the parameters of that would be. There would be a $25 fee. There's the sales tax that's attached to it. This does not pertain to private or recreational use. This is the commercial use that we're looking at here. You would need a permit to do it. You'd have to be 17. You'd have to have a driver's license. In my opinion, I think that's as a form of ID. There would be a test that you'd have to take. There would be a fee associated with it. And, of course, you would have to comply with federal regulations. Those are for the commercial uses of the drone. There's also a component in here that adds for commercial uses, a liability insurance that you would have to have that. And then also there's a rulemaking component for the agency here that would allow them to adopt rules to carry this forward. Also, what's not in here, members, is there's another bill that I was carrying. This is how, if you're wondering why I got the drone bill, okay, I'll tell you why. I had a really, really good bill. It's a public safety bill that addresses medical, public safety, and sheriffs, helicopters, and those concerns will be addressed in the delete all amendment as at the next stop. Basically, what that says is if you have a public safety helicopter, whether it's fire or law enforcement or medical, that you cannot operate a drone within 1 mile without consent of one of these helicopters. I have met with extensively with the stakeholders of most of the public safety agencies, and especially the hospitals, the trauma centers that are running these helicopters. And one of the issues that you have is one small drone about the size of a football. If it hits a medical helicopter, everyone dies. It's that big of a threat. So what we are doing here is we're saying if you want to use a drone within the vicinity of a police or a fire or a medical helicopter, that they have to be, that the owners of the helicopter have to be aware of it, and then you have to have their consent. One of the concerns that we have with the public safety component of this, which we will be addressing at the next stop, is as you know, you got those little GoPro cameras. And it's really cool to put a little camera on a drone, and if there's a crash, a bad accident, or some type of a scene where you've got public safety and medical helicopters that are trying to help the sick and injured, you're going to have people that are going to be buzzing drones around looking for cool footage to put on YouTube. You know what? That's not worth the risk. If the law enforcement or the other agencies, or even if a private entity wanted to use a drone to help out the public safety elements, if they were doing a search, if they're doing some type of rescue operation, that would still be allowable with consent. So, members, that's the bill in a nutshell. Thank you for your questions. Mr. Chair, I'll turn it back to you. I do have some testifiers here, but this is a very good work in progress, and the more it moves forward, the better it gets.
Thank you, Representative Knobloch. I understand
that was Neuberger. I thank you for the comment, Mr. Chair.
Here we go.
I wish I was as smart as Representative Knobloch.
Here's the train of thought. No, thank you, Representative Neuberger. I understand that we did have an amendment. I think that we should go ahead and move that amendment, and I will move.
We don't have it.
Mr. Chair, I believe the amendment that would be the language that would incorporate the public safety helicopters. It was my previous bill, the one that we were going to hear two bills in this committee, and because I respect your time so much, we combined the two into one. Thank you.
Well, then, Representative Neuberger, do you have the oral amendment then?
I do have the. I thought that would be provided for us here, but it is a.
It's coming, I guess.
I think it's coming to us. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, in the meantime, can I ask a question, clarifying question?
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. On line 3.21, I'm a little bit confused, and I'm wondering if there's a word that's miswritten there, where it says operates an unmanned aircraft system either on or over land or water in this state without the consent of the owner of such aircraft. Did you mean of such property, or did you mean aircraft? And I mean, because
Representative Neuberger.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
My name is Cassandra Isaacs, and I'm the director of aeronautics for MnDOT. And ultimately, we did that does mean aircraft. Further in the bill, you'll find also the piece of operating over private property. Ultimately, it means you can't. Drone jack, or you know, like you can't carjack someone, you can't get use someone else's aircraft without their permission, is what the intent. This the language is, it mirrors existing law, Chapter 360 outlines aircraft and has a whole slew of regulations associated with aircraft today. Drones are underneath that regulation, and so the current House file is basically replicating some of that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Neuberger, do you have the amendment there now?
Mr. Chair, I'm looking for a House file here. I apologize to the members of the committee. Things are moving very quickly, and they become relatively discombobulated. I do have the amendment here that would incorporate the public safety component. We had the House file just rewritten into a standard amendment. The amendment is the 3517A1. That's what's before you, Mr. Chair, and I would appreciate you moving that.
Okay, Representative Neuberger, I will move the A1 amendment, and to members, that A1 amendment is line 1.4. It is to add the numeral 6, knowingly operates an unmanned aircraft system within 1 mile of a helicopter being operated by a law enforcement agency, fire department, or emergency medical service provider, semicolon, or. And then on line 1.7, adds the number 6 in quotations and 7 in quotation. So to the amendment, Representative Ugham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Neuberger, once again. With the amendment, why do we have knowingly operates on that rather than just operates? It would seem to me that someone could say, well, I just didn't know I was doing that.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you for the, Mr. Chair, thank you for the question, Representative Ugham. We went back and forth on that a little bit. Initially, the way we had crafted it, it did not have that language in there. There would be times where you would have someone, because of the nature of emergencies and the nature of accidents, they develop and unfold relatively quickly. If someone is out there using a drone they're in the vicinity of something that happens, they're not aware of that. They're not knowingly doing this. Their intent is not to snoop around an accident site. If you've got a farmer who's inspecting, livestock, or if you've got a public utility or a utility out there that's inspecting lines or whatever the purpose is, what we don't want to do is automatically say, here's the crash. Here's the helicopter that's trying to get the injured people out. Oh, and by the way, 3/4 of a mile away is the Ugham drone surveillance company that just happens to fit within that distance. And now, because you're automatically there, you're automatically charged. If you were to be able to demonstrate to us to say, look, you know what, we really didn't know, that would be something for law enforcement to determine. I think that's a threshold that you're going to see, that we see in many other laws as well. So that's why we put that in there. We didn't want to punish people that weren't doing wrong unintentionally.
Okay. Thank you.
Some Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just trying to track the language here to relate to the overview to clarify something. So we say the bill requires a permit to operate unmanned aircraft for commercial purposes, the overview says. But then we exempt aircraft for private use from aircraft registration. We don't exempt them from the permit to operate, though. Is that right? So if you're operating it privately, you still need you still need a permit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, the intent, and the Senate has been, we've been working on some language with the Senate as well. So ultimately the intent is to start dividing up drone users. You have the ones that are over 55 pounds, airplane size. FAA is not really allowing those yet, so they would still be treated just like regular aircraft in state law. For the toys, so you're 10-year-old has one, they're outside playing, all they're doing is just playing with it, it's just a hobby, they would be exempt from any sort of registration or licensing requirements. There's still some laws that would apply to them related to being reckless and harming others and those kinds of things, but they wouldn't need to come to MnDOT and let us know that they exist. The ones that this would be are would be everyone else. So if you're commercial, if you're government, if you're a farmer and you're using the drone to survey your crops, if you're a real estate agent and you're taking photographs, those would be the ones that would need to come to us and get that and pay that fee and do that licensing.
So, Mr. Chair, that makes sense that we exempt them from paying registration fee and tax. But aren't those for private use some of the ones that are, I mean, most of them that are causing the mischief and danger? And so why wouldn't we want to, so we wouldn't tax them or anything, but at least they'd have to get a permit to operate so you'd know, I mean, how do you know they're there and how do you assure that they know the rules?
Ms. Isaacson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, you're absolutely correct. And so I have some numbers for you to give some examples. So one of the reasons that the agency is has brought this to the legislature is we felt that we're at a point where we do need some legislative direction. We need some policy choices around those things like toys. In December, FAA began registering the toys. So if you have a drone, if it weighs less than 55 pounds and more than a stick of butter and you intend to fly it outside, you're required to register it with the FAA today. They began doing that in December. So far, over 400,000 have registered. We anticipate that number to grow exponentially because that's just the ones who know that they're supposed to do that. I suspect there's people in this room right now that didn't know that. They perhaps have one at home. Their kid has a little radio-controlled airplane. Perhaps they had one when they were a kid. They're going to go fly it outside. So there's the sheer volume of it. And ultimately, we've historically not been in the aircraft laws cover those kinds of things, but we have historically not done it. Certainly, if we get direction to do that, that's what we would do. The toys are that. They're toys. Some of them can be quite large, though. They can be up to 55 pounds and be out there doing things. For most of the history of what we used to call radio-controlled aircraft, those folks were part of organized associations, they would have events, they did a lot of training, a lot of those kinds of things. Now folks are buying them online, and whether or not they're going to continue to be a problem as education, it's hard to say. FAA has been trying to do a lot through registration for doing that. So in terms of whether or not we should register in addition to that, that's hasn't been our recommendation, in part due to the sheer volume, but also due to the fact that the commercial folks are the ones who are likely to be in areas such as farming, where regular agricultural spraying, those kinds of activities are going on, and those are the folks that historically we've been engaged with.
Members, I would like to move on the oral amendment, the A1 amendment. Any other discussion on the A1 amendment? Mm-hmm. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. A1 amendment is adopted. Okay, we have a couple other questions, and I do want to get our members out. I understand we both have caucus at 6, so where are we at? Representative Dreskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Neuberger, I guess one question as I read this bill, are we registering government agencies throughout the state, and are we limiting or directing the extent to which the people of Minnesota will allow them to use these drones to look in on the lives of people?
Ms. Isaacson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, government agencies, yes. So today under existing law, government agencies are required to register their aircraft. There's no fee associated with that today. Our recommendation is that they be required to register their UAS and there be a fee, in part because of the sheer number. So today, MnDOT, DNR, State Patrol have aircraft. There's a few other government entities that own it. We will certainly could foresee that every county would have several, many cities, and that there would be a tremendous demand a lot of public interest in which government agencies own that, and so just maintaining that data set, we felt that a fee was appropriate for that. In terms of regulating what they do with it, that's not included in this, other than just the typical regulations that already apply to aircraft.
So Mr. Chair, so a local law enforcement officer or a local ambulance driver would not be liable to the penalties in this bill, is that correct?
Ms. Isaacson?
I don't know that I know the answer to that. I believe that a lot of government entities are self-insured. There's some in terms of the misdemeanor, I'm not certain on that. We can find out the answer, though, and answer that, because it would be the same as regular aircraft is today.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think our missing part here is, you know, I'm most worried about government and their use of this more than I am a free people. So I'm hopeful that maybe that can be added, Representative Neuberger, and we can fill that in. Thank you.
Mr. Bearhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know the FAA is involved in everything that moves in the air. Have we gone to the point that we're, are you satisfied that we're coordinating or not doing things that the FAA, I know on aircraft when they leave the runway at the gate, they're under control of the FAA until they land again at the next. So are we satisfied that we're not interfering or doing something that they wouldn't like, or?
Ms. Isaacson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, what we've proposed aligns with our existing aircraft laws. Our real intent was to start, today's state law doesn't really differentiate. So 360.013 subdivision 37, aircraft means any contrivance now known or hereafter invented, used, or designed for navigation of or flight in the air, but excluding parachutes. So today we have registered 24 drones. We have also issued commercial operators licenses to drone users. We have also sent out some 60 cease and desist letters to drone users that are advertising their services, flying in the state. We've checked. They don't have their FAA authorizations. They haven't got authorizations from us, so we've been doing that. So we've been working very hard. One of the challenges we have is that FAA, they're behind on their rulemaking. We expect it this summer for the small drones, but we have no idea what it will be. So we are working hard to make sure that our laws stay in alignment with where they're going in terms of this. The sheer volume is so much more than we experience in manned aircraft that FAA is kind of learning as they go as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. And members, I do want to be respectful of time here. We are going to go into recess. We will meet 15 minutes after session ends to hear the remainder of this bill and to take up one other bill. So this meeting is in recess. I think I'll call the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee back to order. And thank you all for coming back. Couldn't do it without you. I think we were, in the middle of a couple of questions to our Representative Neuberger. And Representative Earhart, I believe you had finished up in your questioning, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think I got satisfied that the FAA is being accorded with properly, and so I was happy about that.
Thank you very much. Representative Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. We're talking about one of my favorite agencies, at FAA again. I've got a few questions and comments. Number one, the FAA seems to have a lot of rules. I have a federal airman certificate that comes from the federal government. I do not have to be registered to utilize my or exercise my privileges by the state of Minnesota. That being said, I'm finding that this whole bill of requiring drones to be not only registered by the federal, but also by the state, kind of be redundant. And then on top of that, there's a $25 fee. I think I can wing this. Did I say that? Wing it? Sorry. There's a $25 registration fee. And based on what I've seen with government for most of my life, there's always this thing of incrementalism. Minnesota, when it comes to license fees and when it comes to aircraft, is one of the highest in the whole upper Midwest, and we're not talking by a little. It's a lot. So if I almost envision that this $25 license fee or registration fee will go to 50, it'll go to 100. It's revenue. And I'm having a hard time with the revenue portion of this. The other side of this is the commercial application. There's so many things that are regulated and over-regulated and over-regulated by our government right now. If the FAA says, go for it, do we need the state of Minnesota Aeronautics to come in and put their stamp of approval on this? Just to say they did. I don't know what the justification is yet. And then on top of that, if I'm a commercial operator and I fly my drone over someone's farm, for instance, and I'm technically unlicensed by the state of Minnesota, and something happens. Let's say I run it into a prospective client's like a high wire by their house, drops down, kills their dog. Who's liable? The state of Minnesota? No. And I would say that somewhere there's a contract between me and the person who I was doing the videotaping for. Also on top of that, there's an altitude restriction that we've heard going around for quite a while, that these things are only registered only up to 400 feet. Well, my nephew's owned one of these for years, and the whole gimbal and the GPS system on this thing will restrict it automatically to 400 feet. Now, I'm sure there's some guys out there that could change that thing to make those things go up a mile if they really wanted to, but I would say that most people don't know, have the technological skills to do that. But on top of that, there's also this other thing that's been set, I think even back in the 80s, case law, aviation case law, that does give people, and I don't recall if it's 35 feet or if it's 50 feet, if there's some attorneys in here that can answer this question, that would be awesome. But there is a threshold over someone's private property as to privacy. It's not sovereign air, but there is privacy. I don't know what that case law is, but it is already out there. Now, if something actually happens again to somebody's property due to a malfunction or bad piloting skills, there already is liability laws in the books. I look at this entire bill as being a redundant thing for one reason. It's revenue. If there's in the next 10 years, if we have 10,000 people that own these things, and it's $25 right now, and the price goes up, it's kind of like the seatbelt laws. I think it started off at $5, now it's over $100. You know, I just don't have a lot of faith in this. I think this thing has been established to look like it's safety, and it's a revenue thing, in my opinion. Unless somebody can tell me otherwise.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll pass. My question was answered over the break here, and it was in regards to the piloting of aircraft and being caught up in the definition, but my concern has been alleviated.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. Any other questions from members? Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Representative Petersburg, do you want to renew your original motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that this bill be moved to government operations. Oh, no, excuse me, department. public safety, is that correct?
No, it's going to talk about
it is GOP. Okay. I can't remember. It's been so long ago. I move that this bill be referred to government operations.
Representative Petersburg moves House File 3517 to be re-referred to government operations.
As amended.
As amended. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, no?
No.
That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Newberg. Okay, we'll move on. Our final bill of the evening, Representative Knobloch. Representative Knobloch, I see that you had another bill up, House File 2404. Would you like to withdraw that bill?
I would like to withdraw that bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Knobloch. House File 2404 is withdrawn. And Representative Knobloch, I see that we do have a House File now, House File 3691. I will move House File 3691 be re-referred to government operations. Are there any amendments? I don't see any.
No.
Okay. Representative Knobloch, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 3691 is a simple bill. It requires the state to open negotiations with BNSF Railway about extending North Star Corridor commuter rail service to St. Cloud, subject to certain conditions. These conditions include there being no additional cost to the state for the extension, that there be at least two trains a day in St. Cloud, one being a reverse commute, that we allow the rerouting of some other existing service, and that we prohibit the Met Council from having additional involvement in St. Cloud besides that related to the North Star Corridor. The basic concept is to use our existing assets more efficiently. Thus, instead of building a new train station, we would use the existing Amtrak passenger train station in St. Cloud. We would not build new stations in Becker or Clear Lake, as has sometimes been proposed. It is anticipated that the scheduling could be done in such a way that there would not be a need for any additional rolling stock, no new train engines or train cars. There is an existing spur off the existing BNS line next to the existing Amtrak station that could accommodate the North Star train if needed. And the number of miles the train would run each week under some scenarios, one of which is in front of you, this spreadsheet that you should have in your packet, would be almost exactly the same as the current train miles, meaning there should not be any additional operating costs. For example, if you look at the spreadsheet, I show that right now the existing train miles in a week are 2,941 miles in a week. If you, for example, went from 5 round trips out of Big Lake per weekday to 4, dropping by 1 per day, but then did the extension to St. Cloud, you end up with almost exactly the same number of train miles in a week, 2,981 train miles. That, of course, is just one of many options that could be negotiated. The bill doesn't require that, but it's an example of how there could be rerouting of existing train miles in a way that wouldn't add additional costs. In fact, some could argue that this might even save a little bit of money. If you did drop from 5 to 4, I really doubt you'd lose much in terms of fare revenue out of the Big Lake area, but you would gain additional fare revenue by extending the North Star to St. Cloud. I have had discussions with BNSF and understand they do not oppose the bill. You will notice if you look in your packet that my proposal does not appear to violate any of BNSF's commuter rail principles. I would mention there is a lot of additional potential traffic out of the St. Cloud area. A recent study that was conducted by Dr. King Banyan, economics professor at St. Cloud State and former state representative of this body, showed that there are over 14,000 people who live in the St. Cloud area that commute more than 50 miles to their workplace. The vast majority of those 14,000 driving from the St. Cloud area into the Twin Cities. That's this slide that you should have in your packet. And so there is a great deal of potential for people that are in the St. Cloud area right now using the North Star to go down into the Twin Cities. There is also a significant amount of support in the community. I have a letter that I have also put in your packet from the Greater St. Cloud Development Corporation supporting the project, and I have someone else here to testify, Ann Buchwold with the GRIP Isaiah Group.
Mm-hmm. Yes, good evening.
Please state your name.
Oh, yep. So my name is Annie Buchwold. I'm the organizer with GRIP Isaiah in St. Cloud, a part of Isaiah statewide organization. We work in churches, organizing around issues of community concern. So thank you for allowing me to be here tonight and to share with you some of the work we've been doing around getting the North Star extended to St. Cloud. So I just want to say I have a script. I'm going to be turning it in. I will be adding a little anecdote here and there, but I'm going to try to stay focused. But really, I could talk about this train for the next 7 days if I needed to convince people that it should be done.
But don't miss.
I'm not going to do that. I'm going to stick to as much as possible if I can. Okay.
Is the letter in our...
I spoke with Joe. I'm going to make a few edits and turn it in either tonight or early tomorrow morning.
Okay. If you could paraphrase, we'll be able to read the letter as
sure.
well. So.
Sure. So I just want to say, first of all, the North Star campaign grew out of about 12 months ago. The need that we were starting to realize existed in St. Cloud, which is more local bus service, and it hindered people from getting to work, and it hindered employers from getting employees. So it was really around work, getting people to work, that this all started. The BNSF announcement that they were going to drop the second set of rail between Big Lake and Becker was the thing that started us asking the question, wait, would this mean that we can now maybe extend North Star Rail to St. Cloud? So our campaign was really just, do people want it? And all I can tell you is overwhelmingly people have said they want it. They want this train. They haven't asked a lot about cost. They're like, yeah, I would use it for this. I would use it for that. So as Jim mentioned, the Greater St. Cloud Development Corporation has supported it. The Central Minnesota Senior Foundation, which is comprised of 8 counties, they've supported it. We've had like over 6,000 letters of signatures of support. So I can just say there's been no organized opposition and no politically elected leader has stood out and said this should not happen. Okay? Our conclusion is that local support exists and it's been found across all demographics, even across party lines. So we're a nonpartisan group, obviously as a nonprofit, but we found support among senior citizens, veterans, young people, working class, people with disabilities, people from across socioeconomic spectrum, across region. The bulk of those people coming from the 4 legislative districts that we've been working with, Howell, O'Driscoll, Tice, and Knobloch, but we've also had people signing petitions from Melrose, Foley, Albany, Alexandria, Moorhead, Brainerd, down in Mankato, Northfield, Red Wing. I mean, all across the state, people are saying extend this North Star rail. The other thing that people need to know about St. Cloud is we have a poverty rate of 26%, which is twice the average for the state. That's gone up just in the last few years. We need an investment in our community that will drive economic development, create more jobs, more access, more opportunity. Our governor has been talking a lot about protecting the fiscal integrity of our state. St. Cloud wants and needs to be contribute to that integrity, not detract from it. We believe we have much to offer, and greater connectivity will allow us to do that. So we want all of our elected leaders to finish North Star to St. Cloud this 2016 legislative session. We want to highlight the leadership of Representative Knobloch. I know a lot of people say, how could this get done without any money? This just seems incredible. But I will say that we have been working very closely with him. We feel as chair of the Ways and Means Committee, he would understand this issue very well enough to be able to say, like, hey, we could do it without money. And if this committee really believes that it can't be done without money, maybe what we need to do is consider putting some buffer money in there. If we end up needing some money, use it. But if Representative Knobloch can carry out his duties and do it without that money, we'll just put it back in the pot and find some other way to spend that money. We don't need to take money from the state unless we absolutely need it. So we want to get this done. We want to speed things up in St. Cloud, get us back on a more level playing field, and we're happy to see that this opportunity, as much as it's been recognized across the community, it's also been recognized by our local leadership. Okay, next. Sorry. So however this committee chooses to get it done, go for it. But right now we're supporting Knobloch's bill because it's the only bill on the table. And we think it's a good one. Grip Isaiah is open to any possibilities. So we also want to highlight his leadership. We also want to highlight the governor's sentiment that this is a long overdue project. Okay? I moved to St. Cloud region 10 years ago. Back then, people were saying, yeah, why doesn't this train come to St. Cloud? So let's just get it done. We have this opportunity in front of us. Let's get it done. So this is about this session. Let's get it done. It's a short session. There's lots of things to disagree about, but let's not disagree about this. The larger transportation bill, we're not sure what's going to happen with that. We think this idea that we need revenue is actually a real question. How are we going to create revenue that's going to fix our transportation needs in the state? So our campaign has solely been focused on the finishing of North Star, okay? However, as we've been focusing on that, we've been noticing some other things about Greater Minnesota. Number one, it's the 21st century in Greater Minnesota. We like trains. We like rail. We've seen all this enthusiasm. The St. Cloud Times also did a poll, and they were comparing adding lanes to 94 versus extending the North Star. And overwhelmingly, people said extend the rail, and this is before they knew how much it was going to cost, okay? So I'm not saying, like, put rail all over the state, but I am saying maybe this body should take a poll of or start to look at Greater Minnesota and what do they need and what do they want for rail. I know Mankato just came out with an article saying that they wanted rail down there. I know a woman from Northfield's been calling me saying, couldn't you get rail down to Northfield? I'm like, I'm not working on that. You should work on that. But I also think this body should work on that. So operations, so now I just want to say I'm going to step back from the North Star thing for a minute, and I'm just going to talk about what are the things I think that this body should...
Actually, Ms. Buckfield, I do want us to stay focused here, and
okay.
If you have no other comments about North Star, we'll wrap up here.
All right. Well, then all I want to say is, definitely consider this. It's the fastest growing corridor in the state, and North Star would be a lot cheaper, even if it does cost something, than adding lanes on 94 all the way to St. Cloud.
Thank you very much. We do
Thank
have
you.
A couple of questions. Representative Norton.
I don't have questions, Mr. Chair, but that enthusiasm for rail is just something.
Thank you.
Being from Rochester, and we've been wanting rail to come down there, and we have a great proposal that also doesn't cost the state any money, and I'm hoping there's as much enthusiasm for that as there is for this one. But you're right, young people do want something different. They want different types of transportation. They want walkable. They want bikeable. They want public transit. And rail is a big, big part of that. And so I know for my community, we're very excited about the potential for rail and other transit in the future. And I'm very much willing to support this. And thank you.
Great. I also just want to point out that one of the things Representative Knobloch said to us on March 10th is he said, why don't we, do this trial for 4 to 5 years and see how this actually works, considering the fact everybody has said it's a failed line. Seems like a perfect opportunity to put a little bit more effort into finishing up and just seeing if it actually gets used.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do appreciate your enthusiasm, mm-hmm. Ms. Buchwald, and I am very interested in expanding the North Star line to St. Cloud. I'm a fan of that. When you're saying all these people support expanding it, I don't know if they know the intricacies. It's the shifts and gimmicks in this bill, because it's hurting one community and moving those resources to another community. I don't know if you realize that. So my area where I represent would get less service,
mm-hmm.
because we're shifting those resources to the St. Cloud area. So I can't support a bill that harms other communities because people aren't willing to pay for what it costs to make it get up to St. Cloud. So I just want to let you know that's why I'm opposing this bill. It's not because I'm not passionate about getting up to the North Star, but we need a good bill, an honest bill that doesn't use gimmicks and shifts resources from one community to another.
Okay, and I'm sorry, what's your name?
If I could, let me take that. If I could, Mr. Chair, Representative Bernardi, I guess I think it is an honest bill. I guess if you we can talk about some other costs you think shouldn't be here if you want to. It does open up the potential, like I said, of, say, having one fewer round trip in from Big Lake, which would affect your community, let's say having four instead of five. You know, but the other side is I do believe there's going to be a lot of people riding it from St. Cloud. Some of those people are going to go into your community that aren't on the train right now. Some of those people may work in your community. Some of those people may spend money in your community. Some of the people in your community may choose to work in St. Cloud. So there are other advantages to your community as well.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am probably going to be in the same position you are in that I am going to have to support this because it's the only only vehicle right now, and I've been, of course, long believing we should have this connection. You or somebody used the term failed line, and it's an underperforming, I would say. Mm-hmm. It's underperforming because we haven't connected it to the big population center. And the further one is that we have limited service, and so people are afraid they're going to be stuck in the city and have to get a hotel room because the last train has left. And so one of the limiting factors has been the amount of trips into town. And so that's why the lines 116 and 117 trouble me so. I mean, I know it says may negotiate, but I hope that never happens because then we're going to have far more riders, but we limit it because they, again, look at that limitation of service. I believe that when we extend to St. Cloud, we will have many more riders and thus more revenue. And that revenue is spread over the same area. And so, I mean, I would say that might be our experience, that it brings in so much more revenue, so many more riders, that those two lines aren't necessary. Mm-hmm. The one that confuses me a little, and since you're representing that local area, I would hope you might take this back for discussion, because when I read the lines 2-3, the state may not commit to spend any state funds on capital expenditures. That's usually the opposite of what local governments want. They would like the state to share in the cost. But this almost says to me, St. Cloud wants to do it all and doesn't want the state to spend any state money to do this. And I mean, normally I would say it's a public good. It's going to build the economy of that region and thus help us all. So I'm sort of a believer that that the state has a legitimate role to play in our transportation infrastructure. The one that confuses me most of all are 2-4 and 2-5. And I've read them several times. The state may not commit to spend any more state funds on operating costs than the total sum it and the Metropolitan Council have budgeted for the North Star. Mm-hmm. And given the fact you've spent time on that, I don't know if you do you understand what those two lines mean? And what would be the implication, do you think, for the service and your area in those two lines?
You're asking me.
Does that make...
Yeah, well, so while we haven't spent time on this particular bill, we have been in conversation with Jim Knobloch about wanting to see this completed, and I think that he's just trying to demonstrate fiscal restraint and not spend more money at a time when we can't even raise revenue for roads and bridges. And I have reason to believe, as Chair of Ways and Means, if he thinks we can do it within the money that we are currently allotting, well, then let's try to do it that way. Does that make sense?
Representative Knobloch, did you have a comment?
Well, I think I would just say that I've tried to design this bill in a way that it gets negotiations going, and B, I genuinely do think that there are opportunities here where it would not have to cost any additional operating money. For example, the one scenario that I gave earlier. And you know, I don't see the need for additional capital expenditures. I don't think we're going to have to buy additional train engines or train cars. We already have a train station we can use. I suppose it's always possible some may crop up, but there aren't any that I see for sure as something that is definitely a new capital expenditure that we would have to have.
Sim Cosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Chair Knobloch. I was looking at the spreadsheet here. Did you prepare the spreadsheet for the rail mileage, or I'm not sure where that came from. Just kind of curious.
Representative
Knobloch? Mr. Chair, Representative Kosnick, no, I don't know that much about railroads. Actually, I have an old friend of mine who's a retired railroad executive who has been helping me on this, and he helped me with preparing this slide or chart.
Can I make one other comment?
Ms. Buchbold.
Yeah, so I just want to say, too, to your point of state funding. So it's never been Grip Isaiah's position that we're opposed to state funds. In fact, we were saying, let's not wait for the feds, let's do this within our state. Because part of what we're thinking about is that we really need to be a more healthy and whole state. So also, Representative Bernardi, to your point of, you know, hurting one community to benefit another, that you can't be for that. Part of what we're thinking about is that we are one Minnesota, and we have to start thinking and acting like one Minnesota. Also, this body does. So I don't know what the poverty rates are in your community, but when I think St. Cloud is 26%, I'm like, it's time for St. Cloud to get better connected. And if we need to, you know, change something somewhere else, I mean, change is never easy. There's always something that gets hurt in a change. But if the overall goal is to put us all in a better situation, I would, that would be where my vote would go.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard you say what? There's 14,000 people who drive toward Minneapolis to go to work. But I have some stats here, because I think we need to make decisions that are informed by facts. And the U.S. Chamber of Commerce does a report called Where People Commute, you know, to Various Cities, Where They Come From. And 653 commuters from St. Cloud go to Minneapolis. So it's 2% of the people who work in Minneapolis are from St. Cloud. So even if 20% of them use the train, that's really a small number. So I don't know, you know, it seems like we need a better grip on the reality of what the potential is, because it doesn't sound like it could be very much. So I hope that, you know, Representative, that you think about some way to sunset this or whatever. I mean, it sounds lovely, but it may not. I mean, we already have a system that is in the red, right? It runs way in the red, the current train. So all we'd be doing is prolonging that.
Representative.
Thank you.
Well, I would say, Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, first of all, the way the bill is set up, it can't run any more in the red than it is now. I mean, it's limited by that in the bill. Secondly, I didn't say there were 14,000 people commuting to Minneapolis. I cited a study that Professor Banyan did that actually uses IRS information, looks at, as I understand it, like zip codes and social security numbers of people, and that study said that there are 14,000 people living in the St. Cloud area that commute more than 50 miles each way to work. Now, some of them are in Minneapolis. I'm sure the great majority of them are not. You know, many of them would not live along the line. Some of them could take the line, you know, further south down to the Mall of America if they work there, for example. But I guess I just cited that, and this is a real study. It was just released, you know, there's nothing wrong with the data. I've known for years that there are thousands and thousands of people from St. Cloud that commute into the Twin Cities every day. And certainly many of them, most of them, aren't going to have jobs that are along the line, but some of them are. And so I say this to show that there is a significant supply of people that would be interested.
Can I also comment on that? Is that?
Well, actually, it was directed at okay. So we'll move on with the questions to get through here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple of comments and then a question for Representative Knobloch. I think we all know that when the North Star was created, there wasn't enough money to go to St. Cloud, and we ended up at Big Lake. Well, who goes to Big Lake? as far as that goes.
Representative Zerwas isn't here.
Yeah, I guess Zerwas does.
Yeah, Zerwas.
But truthfully, I think everybody in this room realizes that St. Cloud is the natural end connection for the North Star. And St. Cloud is the revenue driver for the whole program. The North Star is a big loser right now. And if you had a business that's losing money, you do two things. You either close it down or you innovate and change it. And this is an innovative bill. This is an innovative bill. It's fiscally conservative. And I just don't see where it has too much downside. Because right now, the downside is to continue to run the North Star the way it's being run. And I know that my constituents in Champlain, Coon Rapids, and even Anoka would use this if it went to St. Cloud. I have hundreds of college kids in my district, and Connie, you probably have some too, that would use this to go to St. Cloud to go to school, because every day when you drive Highway 10, regular commuters, you can just watch the kids drive in the cars to St. Cloud out of the northern suburbs. And as a father, I'm sure that a lot of fathers have given cars to their kids, and at the end of 4 years, they're completely shot because of all the commuting miles and things. But my question, those are my comments, but Representative Knobloch, you mentioned about some of the economic impacts on this, and do you have a feeling, have there been any studies, is anybody talking about some of the other economic impacts for this project?
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum, I guess I don't have any other studies in terms of, you know, other spinoffs that it would have. No, I don't.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hornstein.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm encouraged that we have some bipartisan support for rail, and hopefully we will tomorrow as well. There's another bill tomorrow. But I would classify myself in the same category perhaps as Representative Houseman, maybe a reluctant supporter of this bill. Supporter because I think all the case has been made and made very well why it makes sense to go to St. Cloud. And that will help this line to succeed. But I am a little skeptical that we can do this for free. And I don't know if I see Mr. Appitz, I see Mr. Shetland here. I guess my questions are, my recollection when North Star was first getting going was that there were some painstaking negotiations with BNSF, and there were significant costs, and there were significant legal costs as well. So I don't know if you've had discussions directly, Chair Knobloch, with BNSF, and have they indicated that you know, this is pretty much a limited cost proposition?
Well, Representative Hornstein, Mr. Chair, I mean, I think I have had discussions with BNSF to the extent that they do not oppose the bill. I think that they, you know, as you get into something like this, there, you know, are a number of factors that need to be looked at. I guess I don't, you know, we already have passenger service from St. Cloud. You know, my sense from talking to other people in the railroad industry is that I don't know that there would need to be additional signaling or other costs, but I guess I can't say that for sure. That's one of the reasons to have the negotiation. I guess I think that the state really didn't approach the negotiation the right way last time it did it, and I think it's better to open a negotiation with parameters like this. You know, we do, as you can see, you know, well, let's see. I guess beyond that, you know, as I mentioned, we aren't building any additional train stations. I don't think we need any additional rolling stock. As I think Annie mentioned, there was a problem some years ago where there was only one single track for 12 miles in between St. Cloud and the Twin Cities south of Becker. Because of all the oil train demand, the rail company BNSF built a second track at their own expense here recently, so that is not an issue like it was before. But there are certainly easement issues and things to be talked about here. I would leave that up to the negotiations and see where they go.
Mr. Chair, so thank you for that, Representative Knobloch. I, you know, again, so there's some uncertainty here at best. And I think if past precedent is any indication, there certainly will be some costs here, I think, in lines 1-6 through 1-8. And I also think that Representative Hausman made a good point, because there seems to be an assumption that either the city of St. Cloud and or Sherburne County or surrounding counties will pick up the slack in terms of a local support for this if there are expenses. And I don't know, again, if the city council or the county board have been engaged in that. Are you confident that, you have a pretty cut and dried statement in line 2.3? So I think we are looking at a pretty significant local contribution should there be expenses. So any indication, again, I know Ms. Buchwald said there aren't elected officials that have come out in opposition, but the county board, the city council, the mayor, pretty much on board with this approach of not having the state contribute things?
Representative Nambla.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein. Well, I haven't talked to all of them. I did have a conversation with Mayor Kleiss of St. Cloud over the weekend, and he's told me that they've had conversations with Amtrak, and Amtrak is on board with the idea of using their station. The city would like to redevelop the area around the Amtrak station, and so I would anticipate that if this came to pass, they would maybe spend some city money to do that, some TIF or something. I don't know. I guess as far as I'm concerned, that's kind of their business. They would need to make a decision if they wanted to spend some additional money, if that was something that they wanted to do.
And I'm not, I think that I would argue that it's a good investment for the city. We found, when we have rail infrastructure, we have significant return on investment. So I don't know if, I was just wondering if they were going to do it some sort of TIF district or something like that. But my last question, Mr. Chair, relates now to the Met Council, because we are envisioning some significant responsibilities for them. And, I know that they're going to be involved in operations. And I see Mr. Shetland. I'm not going to ask him necessarily to come down. But I think that the Met Council will have some resources that they're going to need to put into this. And, where those come from will be, I think, a question. So, again, Mr. Chair and Representative Knobloch, I support this, but I'm skeptical that we can do it at no cost. I don't have a problem investing in rail. I just think we have to be honest in terms of, understanding that there will likely be costs to this. And we need to, and I'm not opposed to the state stepping up to help with that. But I'm going to support it because we have to get this done. We have to get this train to the North Star to St. Cloud. But I would just hope that as this bill advances, we get answers to the questions from BNSF. What do they estimate costs to be, or even what kinds of costs? What are the line items? That we get answers from the Metropolitan Council. And finally, I would just conclude that I think this works even better if we have a metro sales tax, we can get people in the metro area to this train and get the people from St. Cloud, once they disembark at the Target Field Center, to where they need to go throughout the metropolitan area. So I think this is part of a larger system. It's part of a larger transit system that we need to invest in. It's not in isolation. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm, again, going to support the bill, but I've got lots of questions. And like Representative Hausman and Representative Bernardi, I really hope that we can look at lines 16 and 17 on page 1, as I shared with Representative Knobloch, my concerns about that. But, that's, again, a funding question. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and I look forward to seeing the progress of this bill and perhaps some funding for it.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Knobloch, for bringing the bill forward. I'm not a fan of the bill, for sure. I struggle with a lot of this. Representative Knobloch, we don't, to begin with, the first time I've seen this bill was today. And I don't know, I mean, maybe I wasn't of the 3,500 bills or whatever. Maybe I should have done a better job of looking for it, but it doesn't even have a number yet. But I think we need to do a better job of getting some numbers and figures together. I mean, where there's speculation that this won't cost any more money, but at the same time, I see a fiscal note here for capital costs from the Met Council. I'm curious what that represents $98 million to $168 million in the fiscal note from them. Like some of the others on the committee have mentioned earlier, you're going to say the state may not commit to spending funds, but what that does is shifts the responsibility to local units of government, and that means property tax increases. And I'm very fearful that we are going to be casting large property tax increases onto the people along the route, including those in St. Cloud, if we pass this bill, and I don't think that's a responsible thing to do. Representative Knobloch, I'm struggling with the bill. I'm going to vote against it, and I don't know what else to offer you. I think this is something that needs a lot more vetting than this. I can see, maybe a work group or somebody, maybe an ad hoc work group that wouldn't even need to be something that would be something we'd pay for, because I know how much I like those as well. Something that actually brought some numbers forward. I mean, this bill is written very broadly for a big project like this. It's a 1.5-page bill that gives all kinds of authority to the executive branch to go forward in a very broad way and to negotiate something that may cast huge property tax increases onto those communities. And I don't know yet about what that means even for our state costs. I know currently we're subsidizing North Star at somewhere north of 80% of the operating costs of that line. Is it 83 or 85%? It's insane. And now we're going to extend it into another community and create more dependency on public-provided transportation. Some of us may call it transportation welfare, these trains that we extend into communities like this. But we're going to create more government dependency for people and only set ourselves up for even perpetuating further this liability that seems to want to never go away with each and every one of these lines that we extend, whether it's green, blue, red, or whatever the color is now in the Twin Cities. The North Star Zip Rail, which would be just as insane or maybe more insane of an idea than this one, but I wish they would have never built it. Thank you for bringing the bill forward, and Mr. Chair, I'd ask for a roll call when we get to that point.
All right. Representative Knobloch. Well, I guess I'd just briefly say, first, it is House File 3691, Representative Driskowski, and I believe the committee administrator posted it on the Transportation Committee website like last Thursday or Friday, so it has been out for a while. You know, in terms of the local government cost, if any, I mean, I guess to me that's up to the local governments. If they feel like this is a good deal and they want to, as publicly elected officials, vote to spend some of their taxpayers' money because they think it makes sense, well, they're elected just like we are, and they need to make those decisions and they need to answer for them. And so I think that I'm comfortable allowing them as elected officials like ourselves to make those decisions. I will tell you, knowing the elected officials up in my area, I don't think they're spendthrifts that are going to foolishly be spending money. In terms of it being a broad bill, I guess part of the idea is to open up the negotiations. I guess I'm open to, if people have other parameters they think I ought to add on as an amendment to do that, I can, but I want to open up the possibility of negotiations and not restrict them too much, and that's why I have a relatively few number of conditions, one of which is it won't cost additional state money, and I'm pleased to see that at least on the fiscal note it says on the operating side there is no additional cost to the state. I would really take issue with the number of the capital costs. I mean, if you go down the line, for starters, they've got $11,100,000 for a new St. Cloud train station, which, of course, we don't need. I could go on through the rest of this. I think many of these are really, not at all necessary or needed. But anyway, you're right. We'll learn more going through the negotiation process. But I do believe, in talking to the people I've talked to and in examining it, that it is potentially possible that this can be done without additional state funds.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you talk about reducing the number of trips from Big Lake to Target Station, are you saying that some of those trips are only going to go to Big Lake and some will go through to St. Cloud? And if that be the case, any one that goes to St. Cloud is actually a round trip for Big Lake. I'm a little confused on what you're planning here, what you're thinking.
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, well, of course, it's subject to negotiation. I was just with this spreadsheet putting out one scenario. This particular scenario would be that there would be one less round trip from Big Lake to Minneapolis each day, and in exchange, there would be two trains up to St. Cloud each day. And if you look at the how those mileages balance each other, the amount you gain on one side is almost exactly equal to what you lose on the other side. And so that would be one way of doing it where I think you wouldn't have any additional cost to the state. But I'm not saying that that's the deal they need to come up with. I'm saying that's just an example.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what I'm saying is if you go to St. Cloud, it's really a round trip for Big Lake, too. Unless they're going to stop halfway down and not go any further, I don't know.
Well, no, Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, the train coming in from St. Cloud would start in St. Cloud, stop at Big Lake, then go to, I think, Ramsey's the next one, then Anoka, or maybe it's vice versa, and so on into Minneapolis. And the reverse commute would go out, but instead of stopping at Big Lake like it does now, it would continue on to St. Cloud.
Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering about why you're barring the Met Council from meddling in something up there that outside of any other agreements on any subject other than operation of the North Star. Are you nervous about the Met Council or what? I can understand why, but I mean...
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, is that a rhetorical question?
Well, I wonder why that's in there.
Representative Hornstein.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just, I know we're moving quickly towards the vote. There's just a few comments have been made about, you know, the nature of the North Star failed line, this and that. You know, the data does not indicate that. The data shows that we've had ridership increase 7%. And, yes, it did take a dip. It took a dip in winter of 2014, that very frozen winter. We had hearings on that in this committee. And what we learned was there were issues with frozen signals. There were issues with freight rail congestion. And ridership took a huge dive because people, they want reliability. And they want the train to get them where they're going and on time. And the North Star has rebounded significantly, both on its on-time record. I think we're well into the upper 90s%. When I went to Ramsey, you could set your watch to it. I visited Representative Whalen and Ramsey. We had a nice conversation with the mayor about some community issues there. But so, you know, the trends are positive. The on-time performance, the ridership numbers are going up, and I think this will only help this line succeed. Because, again, people will ride if there's frequency and reliability and it gets them where they want to go. And so that's why, again, let's extend this to St. Cloud, but let's do it in a way that, you know, gets people there frequently and reliably. And that it will take some additional investment. So this is a line with a lot of potential, and the trends are very positive.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know how I got cut off, but I had a couple more comments. He all of a sudden exploded. So.
I didn't know that he was in the middle of his soliloquy.
Representative Earhart, would you like to finish your line of questioning?
One thing that I didn't understand was, you know, to get that thing to St. Cloud, you really ought to take a shot at getting it to Brainerd, because then you would get some halfway stuff and not just talking about. I mean, that should be your real goal, and then you get round trips even more. But what I was going to ask about, or I was going to suggest, you said 5 or 6 years trial, ma'am, and I noticed that the suburb-to-suburb trial in the metro area here for the opt-outs has failed after 6 months. So I don't think you should go 5 to 6 years on it.
I don't think he meant that seriously. It was just
you did. You said it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I just think that it, because people have said it's an underperforming line,
yeah.
You know, to create a situation where it's creating more revenue and potentially the success of Northstar, which would hopefully be the case, would show that maybe this is something that people in Minnesota want more of, not just in the metro.
Mr. Chair, to that point, I guess I'd just say quickly, when I first was writing this bill, I thought about making this sort of a trial for 4 or 5 years, but as I thought about it more, I thought, well, I'll just leave that up to the negotiation. I mean, I guess I don't know if 5 years is the right number, or 3 years is the right number, or what the right number and conditions would be.
Yeah.
I think that's an appropriate subject for the discussion.
Representative Earhart, are you done?
No, I'm done. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have, I'm not asking for an answer to this. I'm just going to make comment because Ms. Buchvold talked about poverty and those sorts of things. I will tell you about my community.
Mm-hmm.
We have around 50% of our children at our school district get free or reduced lunch. We do have 80% of the people in my district either have no car or one car, and according to the U.S. EPA, we're an environmental justice community. So I just want to have that for the record. The other thing is this part about the part. I want to just read this out loud. The reason why I can't support moving a bill forward like this is that the state may negotiate for fewer round trip departures. It's not talking about one. It's talking about departures from Big Lake to Target Station each weekday and fewer round trips departure on weekends. We already don't have great service on the North Star already. We having more service and having more opportunities to use it is better, not reducing it, mm-hmm. and which will make it more difficult to use the line from our community. And then on line 1.18, it says, BNSF must continue to crew and dispatch all trains and provide other track-related services. I've never really heard the state being successful in telling BNSF what they must do. So I don't know how are you thinking of that? And is that because you want them to keep investing in the quality of the track? And then the other question is, you know, with the North Star, there was a lot of investment put in that track so that passenger rail could use it. So Representative Knobloch, if you could address the quality of the track and the BNSF, that they must continue to use it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernardi, actually BNSF crews and dispatches all the trains, the North Star trains, right now. And so I just wanted it to be clear, and this is, as I understand it, consistent with their commuter rail principles, that they would continue to do that.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, follow up. Did you say that they were thinking about abandoning that track earlier?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernardi, no, they're not looking at abandoning the track. That I know. I'm sure okay. They're not looking at abandoning the track. They just spent many millions of dollars
okay. To
add a second track.
Okay. So then, Mr. Chair, so then the quality of the track and the upgrades needed for passenger rail, how would that be paid for?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Bernardi, I guess I don't know if there are going to be additional costs necessary to upgrade the track for passenger rail. We already have Amtrak service on this exact same rail line out of St. Cloud going to the Twin Cities. I guess, you know, in between St. Cloud and Big Lake and then on to now Union Station and St. Paul. So there's already a passenger train running over this mm-hmm. exact same track.
Okay, so just one more comment, Mr. Chair. I'm very supportive of helping make this get to the track. So I like the idea of, you know, a work group or what to St. Cloud. I like the idea of a work group and those sorts of things. I just want to make it clear. I've talked to my mayor about this bill, and this is not something that our community he's interested in supporting and the way it's written now. But if a different bill came back that didn't affect our community in the way that this bill is, that would be helpful, and I'm not looking for a response. Thank you.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Knobloch, for just thinking really creatively about this issue. We've talked a few times about the bill, and my understanding is, and it's even in the bill, that we're actually hoping that in the long run this saves the state money and doesn't spend anything for at least the state. Although, as you mentioned, you have some concerns with that fiscal note. So, we talk a lot about the North Star and transit in general having to be subsidized, but if this is a way moving forward that we can reduce the amount of that subsidy, which is part of my understanding, is part of the goal of this. I think that it's definitely a worthwhile conversation. To be honest, I'm not firmly on either side of this issue yet, but it sounds like you're very willing to work with committee members to address some of the concerns here. And for me, you know, one of my biggest things would be just ensuring, you know, moving forward that lines 2.3 to 2.5 stay in, you know, that the state may not commit to spend any funds on capital expenditures, and the state may not commit to spend any more funds on operating costs than what they've already budgeted. So moving forward, if it were to move forward, I just would those things, for you at least, be priorities to remain in the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whalen, yes, they would.
Thank you, Representative, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Knobloch, I just really learned about this bill this afternoon, and at first it sounded great because I like this premise always where it's not going to cost anything, and this thing called free. Well, I'm always skeptical when I hear free. Granted, this proposal is still cheaper than a billion-dollar zip line that I remember hearing about in our committee last spring. But I'm looking, the more I keep looking at this, this basically just looks like a bill of negotiations. It starts off, the first line, it says the governor's designee. We don't know who that would really be. And then, I don't know, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines in here which says to negotiate. What happens if BNSF just shuts down negotiations? What happens at that point?
Then I guess we don't have a deal, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Right now, can either one of you tell me what the round trip cost is from Big Lake into the Twin Cities downtown?
$12 for the average, and then that covers all your metro.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
So would it be safe to assume that that price would probably double to come from St. Cloud, since I understand that the Big Lake would be about the halfway point from St. Cloud?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, first of all, Big Lake is about the two-thirds point. It's 27 miles from Big Lake to St. Cloud. It's, I think, 39 miles from Big Lake to the Minneapolis Target Center. I guess it's difficult to talk about the price because the pricing is set up on different ways. I mean, some people buy a monthly pass, some people buy a single day pass. There's a variety of ways you can charge for it. And that's the sort of thing that they would have to decide what is the optimum price point.
Do one last follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Going back to line 2.6 through the remainder of the bill, it's line 7 here. It says the state may negotiate with federal government, counties, cities, and North Star to provide additional funding for services. But the premise that I think this bill came out was this wasn't going to cost anything. But for some reason, in my hesitation, I always think that there's going to be some cost. And even your testifier said, I wrote down her quote, she says, we do not need the money unless we absolutely need it. And that kind of causes a little bit of confusion and concern, and isn't helping with my comfortable feeling with this bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I guess what I would say is, first of all, I'm not going to stand here and say unequivocally it does not cost one more dime to anyone to do this. I don't know that. I think there is a case to be made that it won't cost any more money. I think there's a case to be made that the state might actually save a little bit of money by doing this out of the additional fare revenue they'd get out of St. Cloud. I guess I don't know that for sure. I just, in terms of my conversations, my research on it, I believe that there is a legitimate possibility that this can be done without additional cost in terms of the actual extension of the line. But, you know, I, as I think I mentioned earlier, my city is interested in redeveloping the area around the Amtrak station. That would likely take some additional city dollars, revenues, taxes of some kind if they chose to do that. I guess I don't want to forbid them from doing that if they as local elected officials want to make that decision, or if they as local elected officials that are in the county or city want to participate in some other way that I can't foresee at this point. I guess if the city of Becker wants to build a new train station and negotiate to have it stop there, they could, although I would very much doubt that they would be willing to do that. But I want to leave that open so that elected officials who are like us elected locally can make those decisions if they choose.
Pick your up some Knobloch.
Just one last question here.
Senator Anderson.
Again, going back to the business aspect of this, if this line were selling stock and this really looked promising, the numbers look good, the investors would be lining up to throw money at this instead of coming to us as a body looking for solutions to this. I'd invest in this if this showed a profit. But right now, I'm not seeing a profit.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, we can add your name to page 2, line 8, if you want me to do that.
How <I'll>
fly. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Knobloch. I remember the Transportation Committee went out to St. Cloud sometime in the past year. I just remember the freeway going all the way to St. Cloud was backed up with cars, and it was pretty much the same way coming back. So would this be able to help some of the gridlock that's on the freeway going into St. Cloud?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Mason, I also have a bill to add lanes onto I-94 up to St. Cloud, and I think that's important, too. But I do believe that this would gain some ridership out of St. Cloud, and I'm not going to say that this would eliminate the gridlock on I-94. I'm not going to make that claim. But I do think that there would be a number and a reasonable number of people that would ride it. As I mentioned, there are a lot of people commuting into St. Cloud or into the Twin Cities from St. Cloud by car each day right now.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Please come up to the testifiers table. And seeing the lateness of the hour, I'd ask you to keep your comments to a couple of minutes, please. Thank you for coming. Please state your name for the record.
Right. My name is Frank Lorenz. I'm speaking on behalf of myself as a taxpayer who is weary of the $16 to $17 million a year loss that the North Star has produced. Met Transit has cut fares 3 times, and ridership has increased slightly. But the original forecast indicated that by now there'd be more than 2,700 round-trip riders a day, and the ridership is stuck at under 1,700. So a reasonable man would assume that you have built a boat anchor, a gold-plated boat anchor. 3 weeks before North Star opened, the man who's now the director of North Star, who was the engineer that supposedly oversaw its construction, put out a press release saying that North Star would not reduce traffic congestion on Highway 10 going to St. Cloud, and that was one of the strongest premises for building it in the first place. However, I am in favor of Representative Knobloch's bill as written, because if it stimulates negotiations without mandating that some conclusion be reached and money be spent by the shovelful, it's at least a step in either trying to reduce the losses of North Star or shut it down. If extending the line to St. Cloud could generate 1,000 additional round trips per day, 5 days a week, that would add revenue of $4.68 million a year, and that would be a substantial reduction on the $16 million a year loss. Right now, you're subsidizing each rider of North Star to the tune of about $16,500 a year, and for that amount of money, if you divided the 1,700 people into groups of five and bought them a permanent chauffeur and a $250,000 stretch Mercedes limousine, they wouldn't need the North Star. So it's a huge amount of money that's being wasted. The problem is, and I'll finish with this, a couple of years ago, the boosters from St. Cloud got together and decided that they needed direct airfare out of the airport to Chicago. They'd lost their air service to Minneapolis, St. Paul, because the federal government won't subsidize air service unless the community is more than 100 miles away from the main airport. So they politicked around and got a federal grant of about, what was it, $800,000? I can't remember the exact number. And they and one of the regional commercial airlines came in and ran that Chicago St. Cloud service until they ran out of money. And less than one-sixth of the people who signed a petition saying they would use the service actually showed up on a regular basis to use it. So the caution you need to exercise is that the numbers from the professor at St. Cloud or from Met Transit or from whoever wants to make this next leap of faith to double gold plate the boat anchor, you need to really sign up the people who say they will ride from St. Cloud to Minneapolis and get them to pay a year's fare in advance, because otherwise they'll just sign the petition because they think it'll be good for something, good for business, good for my ego, good for poor people, good for gophers with hemorrhoids, whoever needs help. It'll be good for them, and therefore what it costs doesn't mean anything. And to Representative Baskowski's comments about the colors on the increasing number of light rail lines, the next two colors up are mauve and puce.
Thank you, Mr. Rentz. Mr. Shetland.
So the bottom line is I'm unhappy, but I support his bill as written.
Okay. Thank you for your support of the bill.
Mr. Shetland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to be here to speak to this bill. And before I get started, I'd like to explain the fiscal note. I know it was brought up a couple times, and I did have a chance to talk to Representative Knobloch about this twice today, actually. And the fiscal note was written prior to the bill language that was being drafted, so it's off quite a bit. And so we will be, Mr. Lee sent us a new request at about 3 o'clock today that we'll be working on. If this bill moves forward, we'll have a new fiscal note ready for folks. But one of the things that we talked about in the fiscal note that still holds true is that we do believe that there are some costs included in this bill, and I shared that with Representative Knobloch earlier. We are excited to be here. We do support expanding this this North Star line up to St. Cloud, and think that that would be a great approach to take. But we would also, if we were going to extend that, we would like to add to that rather than harvest from the current service today. Now, if the bill as introduced were to stay, we do think that there are costs related to indemnification. Currently, the line that when we originally negotiated this back in 2007, there was a one-time payment of $107.5 million for that right-of-way to BNSF for those 18 trips that were going to be going in and out of the stations each day. And we would anticipate that there would be an additional cost that we would have to negotiate potentially for those other stations, along with the indemnification that's necessary and that was required when we negotiated that this back in 2007. There are also potential some operating costs. We believe that and we'd have to look at Representative Knobloch's information a little bit closer. I haven't had a chance to read his chart, but there are additional costs that go along with that service, to the extent that his language, which we've received today as well, we need to look at that a little bit further. But there are also issues with the Amtrak station and federal law that requires that they need to be ADA specific. And I don't know if that particular station is ADA compliant at this point. From what I heard very briefly is that it may not be. And so there are a lot of unknowns in this bill. And so if we were going to move forward with it, we need to take a little bit closer look at what those true costs are. But I also wanted to say that we are interested in seeing this bill or the service be extended to North Star. But we don't believe that it can be done without any additional funds. And if the state is going to not pay for those and put a just bar the state from putting in those additional dollars, we'd need to see who else would be able to pay for those. Because I know Representative Knobloch mentioned that the railroad is neutral on this bill, but that doesn't mean that the railroad isn't going to expect payment. And so that needs to be kept in mind as we move forward. And I can take any questions you may have. But again, I apologize for the fiscal note. That was done in error, and so we will be fixing that if the bill moves forward.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just testing a premise that I talked about earlier. If you connect with a major population center that's new to the system, presumably you draw in many more riders, and many more riders means more revenue to the system. That would be an assumption one could make, would you think?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, I think that is an assumption that could be made, but again, it's an assumption. And while we are attracting additional riders, which would be great, we at this point can't tell you what the true costs of extending that service are. And until we see that and know what that cost is going to be, that's just an unknown that you know, I can't speak to at this point. But the fact of the matter is that we support going to St. Cloud because we agree that there's going to be ridership. But we would prefer to add it on top of our current service rather than taking it from service that is already agreed to. We own the trackage rights today. We have the service, as Representative Hornstein mentioned. We are seeing a rebound in North Star. We talked about this many times in committee. I think it was 2 years ago that we had soft track issues. We had a really crazy cold weather that winter, and then they were BNSF was doing some maintenance on their track, which is great. And you know, it actually in the long run it helps our service, but in the short term, the service reliability was down. And so we are now seeing that come back, and in 2016 already we're seeing about a 7% increase in ridership, and that's holding. And so again, rather than extracting from current service, we'd rather add to it, because we do believe, as Representative Knobloch is saying here, is that they think that there is latent demand up in the St. Cloud area that we think would be provide a boost to the overall service.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Shettenden. Mr. Shettenden, you I think confirmed what I had thought initially, which was there would be costs with the railroad. You had mentioned a pretty high cost, you know, initially. This might not be that high, as, you know, things when you start up and you start these things tend to be more expensive, but there will be costs. And again, I know this is a negotiation, so anything we would say here in terms of an estimate would be speculative, but if you have a range, you know, you mentioned this indemnification. I think you correctly stated nothing would come for free. But do you have a range of what this might cost with the railroads?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, I do not. I think that is something that we would need to look into further. I will say the original number that I provided really dealt with the line from Target Field out to Big Lake. And now with Representative Knobloch's bill, and forgive me if I'm explaining this wrong, he is suggesting that we reduce a previous route and extend that then to St. Cloud for one or two trips, or one in the morning and one in the evening. And so he's saying to negotiate that trackage right would be for less time than we have on the previous amount or line from Big Lake in. So that number would be reduced, I would think. But I'm not going to speak on behalf of BNSF. I think they would be able to speak to this better than I can. But I just know that based on our, and I mentioned this to Representative Knobloch earlier today as well, that based on our previous dealings with the railroad, that there are costs included here, and somebody is going would have to pay for them for it to work out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. On that, along those lines, Mr. Shannon, wouldn't it also be possible, though, if the railroads were looking at that, we know they had some capacity issues the last couple of years, and they saw that as opening up that possibility for them, for their use, doesn't that also suggest that they may look at that as a revenue provider as opposed to wanting to give away that track? I mean, we could go both ways, but isn't that a possibility as well?
Mr. Chair, I think anything's possible, but I think that they would see that as a revenue-making opportunity in order to make sure that they are providing that track time available. I don't know why they would take a different approach than what we have experienced on the previous in the previous negotiation, which was a substantial amount of money.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from members? Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify on this bill? Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
And Chair, Representatives, I'm Victoria Nill with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. I work in the transit section, and the governor is very excited to work with Representative Knobloch on this bill, and we're very excited to see the service extended up to St. Cloud. We just wanted to make you aware of the time and the state resources that it would take to negotiate with BNSF. We work on lots of transit, large transit projects in this state, and we have a little bit of history with negotiating with BNSF, and there's several steps to the process, and the BNSF negotiation team is really made up of three different groups. Two of them are national, and one of them is local. Locally, we work with the group to talk about what has to happen on the track, what improvements need to be made, crossings, signal timing, time slots that we can operate in. We work nationally with their legal staff, and that's where the actual documents come from, where you need to negotiate your purchase agreements, your service agreements, how often you can run your lines, also your future operations and maintenance agreements. So there's several legal documents in this legal group that we need to negotiate with. And then lastly is their administrative branch, also national out of Fort Worth, where we need to talk big picture on how we're going to deal with policy, procedures, what are our fundamental operating needs, and what are our fundamental service needs here in the state, and get those. So we have to negotiate with all three groups, and the two I've emphasized twice is they're national. So getting them here to Minnesota to negotiate with us is pretty hard to get on their calendar. And so just wanting to let you know that these negotiations on average take 2 to 4 years of state time and resources to negotiate. So just wanted to bring that aspect to the bill also.
Thank you very much. Representative Runbeck.
Mr. Chair, so there's so many unknowns. I mean, it just seems like this is hard to vote on. We don't know enough, and I don't know if it would be better to call it a study. I don't know if Representative Knobloch would consider something less than the term, you know, negotiations, which makes it sound like we know all the pieces, and we don't. But something, it's just not ready to be voted on, I don't think.
No, it's
Thank you, Representative Runbeck. I think we've had a very good meeting. I think we've had a lot of very good questions and testifiers. We appreciate your time in being here, and members, I appreciate the time in being very thoughtful with your questions and being here. So we are going to move on this bill tonight, and we are going to take the vote, and a roll call vote has been asked for, so we will be doing that. Representative Hornstein, I think you have another question.
Yeah, just to you, Mr. Chair. Could you refresh our memory in terms of where is this going to the floor? Is it going to Ways and Means? What is the next destination?
This will go to government operations.
Or GovOps, okay. Great. Well, Mr. Chair, then I hope that, it seems like there are, some fiscal issues, certainly with MnDOT, it would appear, and possibly with the Met Council. And so it sounds like we are going to get maybe a revised or more up-to-date fiscal note at some point. Is that the plan?
That's what it appears to be, yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions from members? Representative Knobloch, I'll just add a couple comments. We do have the MnDOT's actual report, the Gateway Status Report of 2015, showing the budget for North Star Line is expected to be $17.6 million with anticipated fare box revenues of $2.5 million. So we do have a net operating cost for the line right now, and Representative Druskowski, you brought that up. But I do want to echo actually Representative Whalen, who said, I appreciate this kind of outside the box thinking that says I don't believe we're going to go backwards and dismantle the entire operation. So I appreciate the fact that you looked at this as an opportunity and possibly a way to make this more efficient and to extend that up to St. Cloud, where there is a population base that would probably use it. So I want to commend you for this bill and for bringing it forward and for everyone's comments and thoughtful process here. I absolutely do appreciate that. And with that, Representative Knobloch, I'll give you the last final comments on your bill.
Well, it's been a long evening. I appreciate people's comments, and I would simply urge your support for the bill.
Thank you, Representative Knobloch. I will renew my motion that House File 3691 be re-referred to the Committee of Government Operations, and a roll call has been requested, so we will conduct the roll call.
Chairman Kelly.
Aye.
Vice Chairman Petersburg.
Yes.
Representative Chad Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Mark Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Atkins. Representative Bernardi.
No.
Representative Draskowski.
No.
Representative Earhart.
Yes.
Representative Hausman.
Yes.
Representative Hornstein.
Yes.
Representative Howe.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Koznick. Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Mason.
Yes.
Representative McNamara.
Yes.
Representative Nash. Representative Norton.
Yes.
Representative Runbeck.
Aye.
Representative Sanders.
Aye.
Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Representative Uglum.
Yes.
Representative Whalen.
Yes.
There being 17 ayes and 3 nays, motion passes. Members,
Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Representative Knobloch. Members, our next committee meeting will be in a few hours at 12:45 in the basement. Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.